Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
Radha Iyengar.
And Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And thanks for joining us for a very special Mother's Day edition of Bombshell.
Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there.
And all the mothers-to-be. And we will have some special guests here at the end. Our moms are joining us. So we're going to wade through all the craziness of D.C. and the foreign policy community here as per usual. But then we're going to talk to our moms about...
We get the insider scoop on the insiders.
Like, were we always like this?
Short answer, yes.
Yes.
Turns out.
But and also our- what they thought about the Cold War and Vietnam and all kinds of other things. So... We have a lot to get through before we get to that special special segment.
What are we drinking this week, Erin?
We are drinking one of my absolute favorites, which I like to call Costco margaritas. Anybody who follows me on Twitter is familiar with my love of the Costco margarita. I have to say that my dinner party circle is a big fan of the Costco margarita. They are $9. They include alcohol. They are perfect for the summer.
They are not for the lighthearted, I would say.
They're really not.
And we might have had quite a few already. So.
So welcome to a very special edition of Bombshell for Mothers.
That's right. It's been fabulous. We have a few program notes before we dive into keeping up foreign relations. The first of all, as always, is if you love Bombshell, and we know that you do, do us a favor and rate us in iTunes. There are some other ways of doing it in Stitcher and in a couple other apps, but iTunes seems to be the main thing. So leave us a review, leave us a rating. It helps quite a lot. The second is next week on May 16th, we have an event with Young Professionals in Foreign Policy where we're talking about being disruptors in national security. And there's really nothing more disruptive than women in national security, I have to say.
Drunk women especially.
You can. It's open to YPFP, War on the Rocks, and DEF members. So by all means, get in touch, log on to the War Hall, and check out our announcement on that event. The week following, on May 23rd, there's an excellent civil military conference sponsored by CSIS that several of us will be at. And there'll be some podcasts later this week and next from our good friend Alice Hunt in support of that. And finally, on the Think Tank conference circuit, we will have here shortly the announcement for the CNAS annual conference, where you'll be able to attend a very special live broadcast of the Bombshell podcast.
It's going to have smoke machines and lasers.
I've been told the pyrotechnics budget for this is actually considerable. So if we don't spend it on booze, we're going to spend it on fireworks, and it's going to be great.
As long as you don't light my booze on fire is all I'm asking.
But we could.
We could.
As long as there's some left
to
drink.
Thing. Well, yes, we also would like to drink it. That's true.
It'll be called the Flaming Mame, and if you get that reference, you're awesome.
All right. Well, without much further ado, let's talk about keeping up foreign relations. It's been a couple weeks, obviously, since we talked to everyone last. What's going on in the world, folks?
Okay, so what's going on in the world is apparently there are U.S. forces on the ground in Somalia. And why do we know that, Radha?
Well, somebody just died, unfortunately. But we also know it because they've been there for a while.
They have been there for a while. But is this really something that we talk about a lot in U.S. foreign policy, having special operations forces in a number of theaters in the world?
It is not. It is not for a couple of different reasons. One, obviously, there are operational concerns around this. Two, a lot of their missions are sensitive and counterterrorism focused. But three, apparently most of America doesn't pay that much attention to it, especially in Somalia, where there were a lot of political sensitivities to it. But we've actually had that Somalia mission sort of ongoing, mentioned in the president's NDU speech, President Obama's then president NDU speech. So, you know, we've been kind of keeping at it in Somalia to try to control the terrorist forces there for some time.
But at the same time,
the AMSOM forces.
I think this is the first U.S. forces death in Somalia since Black Hawk Down.
Yes.
And the service member who was killed was actually, if I remember correctly, in an advisory role.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about like what is the distinction that this administration makes in terms of like being in an advisory role versus being in other kinds of roles?
So in many of the places in which we are combating terrorist groups, the spaces are ungoverned, and we are working sort of on two lines. One line is the one we're sort of familiar with raids and direct action, sort of finding bad guys and killing them. But the other one is advising and assisting forces that are attempting to stabilize, secure, or even just sort of minimize the instability, even if they can't stabilize key areas. In the case of Somalia, a lot of that is done by foreign forces in a unified group called AMISOM, which is an African Union peacekeeping operation. And U.S. Special Operation Forces have been advising that this administration and in the last. I think the difference is obviously the rules of engagement on what those advisory forces can do shifts over time and shifts with administrations. And so we're kind of waiting to understand a little bit better what maybe happening with those advisory forces in this context.
And there was, that's similar, obviously, to the mission set at this point in Afghanistan, where there were also two service members killed. I believe it was a SEAL that was killed in Somalia and two Rangers who were killed in Afghanistan. I'm not sure, actually, that the Rangers were on an advisory mission, but there's, I think it's part of the, it's an interesting part of the political calculus and part of the strategy calculus of trying to figure out, in general, how to reduce the risk to U.S. forces, but then also still be really operationally effective. And we're there's a request now in Afghanistan for an additional 5,000 or so, maybe conventional troops, if I remember correctly.
Right. That the official strategy hasn't come out yet, but the rumor is that we'll be looking for an additional 5,000 troops with some sort of discussion of what the broader strategy for that is, hopefully in the coming weeks.
And that kind of plays into some, Tony Thomas gave testimony last week, week before, with regard to Special Operations Command. He's the four-star down at SOCOM, about how overstretched SOCOM is and how we've kind of really become to rely on them as the, not the force of last resort, but the force of first resorts.
And all resorts.
And all resorts. And I think that that's, I'm not sure I know exactly where this administration, the Trump administration, comes down on the balance of effort between special operations and conventional forces. But certainly there's been an impulse probably for 10 years, maybe for 15, to say, well, you know, SOF is kind of the one ring to rule them all, and it's like a magic bullet.
And that it doesn't really count as U.S. forces on the ground. Like, whenever we talk about, you know, there are no boots on the ground in whatever theater, which has become the kind of mantra these days, talking about SOF never seems to fall into that category. I suppose they have slippers or high heels, or they have no shoes at all, or something along that line. But the tendency of both this administration and the prior two administrations to not recognize that SOF constitutes like an active use of U.S. forces overseas, that there's a real risk that we should be talking about with the American people, and that service members do indeed, you know, are harmed and are even killed in these theaters, really disturbs me in a lot of ways. And it disturbs me about the future of SOF in terms of how it's going to be used over time, where it doesn't really count if we've sent SOF there, and therefore we're not actually in combat zones overseas.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think I worry that we have a different tolerance and risk calculus for special operations forces in some senses because we think they're taking on a different mission set. But as that mission set bleeds over into mission sets that look awfully similar to mm-hmm. ones that conventional forces are taking, I wonder both about the use of these relatively small and really extraordinarily capable and trained forces for this broader mission set and what that means for their availability for the sets of missions that only they can do. But also, you know, I worry that we don't take seriously enough the risk to life that those forces undergo in these circumstances. And we kind of, a Navy SEAL dies and we think that that's something they've signed up for in a way that we don't tolerate for conventional forces.
And certainly General Thomas's point was that this also has readiness implications yep. for the SOF community in much the same way that other operations have impacted, whether it's naval aviation or the ground forces or whatnot. And I think that that's going to be interesting to see. That's part of what a strategy, you know, helps provide right. you with, right? It's priorities and resources. And
I know, I can't believe I'm going to make Lauren's point for her here, but
yes!
I fear that sometimes when we use special operations, we think we're just using them for this narrow thing, so we don't have to come up with a strategy. You know, if you use them only for that special thing, maybe that's the case. But if you're using them for everything, at some point, there's got to be a strategy to why you're using them.
For sure. The other big thing in the news this week are the second round of the French elections.
Yes, I'm going to confess right now that every time I see Macron, I think he is a macaron, which is a lovely French dessert.
It is.
He is also a lovely French man who is apparently going to be the president, sworn in within a week, which, by the way,
wow,
the French have executed two rounds of elections and a swearing-in ceremony, and the time that it takes to, like, you know, register to vote in the United States. So this is, you know, props to them for being a Western democracy that manages to get things done relatively quickly, but also not fall prey to the latest round of WikiLeaks, apparent Russian hacking, whatever has gone on in the last couple of days for the Macron campaign.
And part of that's a little bit about the way that the French media have a set of rules around campaigning and survey results, actually, and media coverage in the final round going into the French elections. One of my favorite podcasts is the Revolutions podcast, and I've been listening to both the most recent bits on the Revolutions of 1830, but also the older ones on the French Revolution, which have been a good reminder about the Rousseau concept of the general will, which sort of animates French politics in a very different way than we think about it in the U.S. And so there's some norms there that I think helped the media resists some of the baser instincts that we often fall prey to both here and in the UK with regard to sort of salacious media coverage. You know, but that said, you know, this is now the second election following the Dutch elections a couple months ago, where the populist candidate kind of had a surge, but then peters out in the final round. And I think that's
and
giving
the German party elections, too, which sort of backed up.
Yeah. So I think there's some folks who, I mean, I don't think anybody's really celebrating. I mean, you know, this is still the best showing for the National Front in quite some time. I mean, they got
35% of people still voted for them.
Although even more cast an abstention ballot, which is sort of a fascinating concept to Americans that you would show up to vote, but then
you don't
vote for no one.
Yeah.
Fascinating
that the voter turnout was something like 70% and that the French were decrying low voter turnout, which
absolutely.
I was like, whoa, wow.
70%, guys.
I was thinking, wow, 70%, that's pretty good.
That would be world historical highs for the U.S., at least for our lifetimes. But yes, that has been low for France. So that said, there's been some interesting, I mean, it remains to be seen kind of what direction Macron takes, you know, all of his policies. He made a couple of statements that are very pro-EU and then juxtapose the British policies as being quite pro-US, which is kind of an interesting Gaullist throwback. So I think people are kind of breathing a sigh of relief, certainly on the American side of the Atlantic, but it remains to be seen, you know, really still what direction Europe takes. The hard Brexit line is pretty intense, it sounds like. And of course, the UK has upcoming elections here, snap elections that they've called, that will take place in June. But their Brexit negotiations remain kind of a hot mess.
And I read today that Facebook has taken down several thousand fake news sites that are related to the UK election already. So the way that the propaganda disinformation theme impacts the UK election is going to be fascinating to watch. But so lastly, in terms of topics that I frankly don't understand at all, Venezuela, what's
Speaking
going
of hot
on?
Messes.
Hot mess. What is going on in Venezuela?
I think that the complicated piece of this here, one is basically it's a collapse of the Maduro government, but it's a story that is 15, almost now 20 years in the making. And it continues to garner almost no attention in Washington. It's a function of kind of our Latin American policies in general. On the Defense Department side, it's part of Southcom. Southcom is, I wouldn't want to call it a backwater, but it is certainly like not generated a ton of attention, partially because governments in Latin America are not super eager to have a lot of U.S. troops roaming around with any great frequency. Colombia is sort of the exception to that and is an interesting exception to that. But Venezuela continues to have incredible hyperinflation, large-scale protests, and now, kind of speaking of this, like, Revolutions podcast, this interesting potential throwback to defections from the army itself. And so will they actually be able to put down the protests from the government's perspective and from the, you know, public side, force a constitutional change that's meaningful? But certainly this, I think, is a place that's often overlooked in the DC conversation and in terms of security expertise.
I remember in 2009 having a debate in the Defense Department about planning contingencies in the Central America about government collapse. And there was an unwillingness to even talk about it as an impact to the U.S. national security because of basically the fear of politicization and whether or not it would have any impact on our relationships with those governments.
So we'll see what we can do. We'll keep an eye on that and see if we can find some outside folks to come in and help us out on that topic here in the coming weeks. In terms of White House mayhem, the White House continues not to disappoint for people who love this segment. We have ongoing, as we speak, a set of hearings on Capitol Hill with Sally Yates and former Director of National Intelligence, Clapper. We're not going to report on those in real time from this show. The Flynn news tends to move faster than this podcast, and so you can check our Twitter feeds or your, you know, fake news source of choice to see, you know, what's going on there. But one agency that did make a lot of news in the last couple of weeks was the State Department.
Yes.
It is apparently all office space there all the time at the moment. So, Lauren, what happened at State last week?
So in the State Department, we have a number of things going on. They're doing an internal review just to see, like, how should we reshape the State Department, which is totally valid, which you normally do that sort of thing before you say you're going to cut 2,300 staff and a number of offices within your department, just my personal advice. We also have a number of fascinating statements that Secretary Tillerson has made in terms of, you know, the United States will no longer basically make human rights a priority in terms of its negotiations or relationships with other foreign powers, which, you know, this may be debatable amongst other people in terms of how we have a kind of realist foreign policy. But at the same time, to have him very publicly and baldly state this was fairly shocking to a lot of people, including Senator McCain, who had a really powerful op-ed today, Monday, refuting a lot of Secretary Tillerson's claims there. And then lastly, just the both the State Department and the Trump administration have, in the last weeks or so, decided that they are going to have a White House visit with Duterte. Sorry, that was a total fail on my part in terms of name remembrance, which people were really unhappy about based on, like, this president has personally himself both encouraged and actually killed drug dealers.
The Philippine president. Not the American president, but the Philippine president.
So far as I know, the American president has not personally killed people in the Philippines yet. Duterte, on the other hand, has now both been invited to the White House and also engaged in those activities himself, which
by his own admission.
Right. He's very proud of this fact. So a lot of people who aren't even, you know, bleeding heart liberals say this is problematic in terms of the sort of how favoring we are of the administration in the Philippines. And I'm curious what you guys think about this balance of both human rights versus realist foreign policy. We frankly need the U.S. access in the Philippines for our military. How do you balance those issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an interesting question. The Duterte invitation was joined by a statement from the president that he himself would be willing to negotiate directly with Kim Jong-un, one that's direct bilateral negotiations, which we haven't had with the North Koreans in quite some time, but also to meet with the actual, like, top-level negotiations, not staff several levels down. And obviously, it also follows the somewhat celebratory call and readout of the call to Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan, or President Erdogan, with regard to his...
win, air quotes.
Yeah, win, quote, with regard unquote, to their referendum. So there does seem to be the shift.
This tendency to overlook shadiness, one might say.
So, and I think it's important to contrast, you know, sending... having a conversation with someone who is going to be another head of state that you will have to interact with, I think is pretty standard and something that would happen in all administrations.
Totally.
I think the difference that many people are pointing to has to do with the type of language and the sort of general openness and tolerance of the behavior, or lack of calling out sort of bad behavior while congratulating. And in particular, in the case of the Philippines, kind of coupling this language with some relatively negative language to our ally, South Korea, on them paying for their own missile defense, and, yeah, and then willingness to do bilateral negotiations at the top level with North Korea, then a slightly questionable claim on the relationship between the Philippines and North Korea strategy kind of leaves, I think, a lot of people trying to figure out what our Asia strategy and our sort of general nationwide or international strategy is with regards to authoritarian states who we think we need to deal with for other purposes. And I think kind of how much you hold your nose and how much you chastise while holding your nose versus shun is an area of general debate. But I don't totally know that we have a consistent view of of chastising.
I mean, here's the thing. Like, we are going to have to always deal with, as the United States, regimes that are uncomfortable to all of us for a number of reasons. Like, there's nobody's advocating we should totally cut off relations with the Philippines. And there's a number of people who think that negotiations with North Korea are an interesting step to go in this direction. But at the same time, like, there are diplomatic signals that people understand in terms of, we're going to do this, but we're not happy about it. People understand, both in the U.S. community, but also in the international community, they understand these signals. And for the Trump administration to be like, we don't need to care about those, let's just do things our own way, they're blowing that off in a way that I don't think the rest of the world has necessarily caught up with, in a way that is really unproductive for U.S. foreign policy.
So you mentioned John McCain had a piece on Monday this week that was pretty powerful. Elliot Cohen had a piece a few days ago that made sort of similar points. And these were classic American exceptionalism, values-driven foreign policy arguments that we expect from a certain portion of the hawkish right, right? A couple of friends tweeted a piece from a few years ago by Henry Farrell and Martha Fenimore that's basically like, it was actually done in response to the Snowden leaks talks about the end to American hypocrisy, that because we have, between the Snowden leaks and the Manning leaks, we can see the internal discussions, but that kind of in a world of arch transparency, it's really difficult for the U.S. to hold their nose in the way that we've just been talking about, or to make these signals that, like, we're going to do it, but we don't like it, that phase is sort of over. And I guess the question is, I mean, some have criticized the Obama administration for not being as forceful on human rights
right.
and American values as the Bush administration was
right.
or as the Clinton administration had been, which is part of this interesting overlap between liberal hawks and neoconservatives that either people love or get really uncomfortable around. But is, you know, is it the end of hypocrisy? I mean, are we just in a much more brass tacks, you know, bare knuckled world that there isn't room for human rights to be at the forefront of these policies anymore?
I'll be honest. I feel about this a little bit the way I felt about the strikes in Syria that happened several weeks ago, which is, I'm not actually on its face opposed or supportive of either. Like, I'm willing to kind of reserve judgment. But I worry that we've entered a phase in which the administration doesn't feel the need to justify or rationalize or establish a coherent worldview that they're pursuing. And I think that's my sort of discomfort with this. It's not in the individual tools themselves, but I would really like there to be a voice coming out of this administration. And whether, frankly, it's the State Department or it's Jared Kushner at the White House or it's some other, you know, expert coming out of the National Security Council that lays out, okay, look, we have a, like, uber realist, like, here are our objectives. We have three objectives. We're going to work with anyone who helps those objectives and ignore anything that's not in support of those objectives. Now we can debate those objectives and let's kind of live and die on that that sort of policy. But I feel like right now, I at least still play a lot of catch up in trying to read between the lines of what different actions mean and how they all fit together into a worldview I can understand. And I would like to be in a place where the administration feels that it owes it to the American public to explain its priorities and how these things are consistent with it. And I guess that's my concern.
I mean, I feel like sometimes we're operating in an uber realist administration that thinks it's an American exceptionalist administration. Like, it's the scrawny guy from middle school who thinks he's ridiculously hot and that everybody should want to date him. And I have no really further ability to continue with that analogy. I just want to leave you all with that thought.
Excellent.
Well, I think it's, you know, I taught undergraduate course on U.S. foreign policy last fall and assigned Walter Russell Mead for the first time. And so the Mead book on U.S. foreign policy is mostly known for its emphasis on Jacksonian foreign policy, which gets brought up both with respect to Trump, obviously, but more broadly. But what is interesting about kind of the way that Mead lays this out is there's three other schools, right? There are Hamiltonians, Wilsonians, and Jeffersonians. And there are strands of all of these things in the history mm-hmm. of American foreign policy.
Only one of which has a musical, but we're waiting.
Some of those can make better musicals than others,
fair.
I think. What was interesting to me, because I'm a total nerd, is in reading this, we had assigned this piece just after we had talked about, like, the Congress of Vienna and Metternich and Talleyrand and all of this. And Mead has a whole piece about why we are not continental realists, why being born of the American Revolution and having two large oceans and having the political history that we have, we are not pure continental realists in a kind of Metternich-like sense or in a Bismarckian sense. And that always comes, one, I don't think we're actually very good at it. Like, our American foreign policy is a little too isolationist to be that in the mix and all of these backroom secret deals. I think it's hard to make those kind of secret deals in the 21st century to begin with. But also, you know, we're your opinions of Henry Kissinger, you know, sort of notwithstanding, he's not running foreign policy.
Right.
And these kind of incredibly transactional, highly specific negotiations, one-to-one, leader-to-leader, which seems to be what the president prefers. I mean, he wants to make a deal himself based on personal relationships with whether it's Duterte or Xi or Kim Jong-un or whomever. That's actually really hard. And it's really hard to do in the 21st century. And it's really hard to do with the sprawling foreign policy and security apparatus that we have. And so I agree, we don't have a strategy, nor do we have a policy apparatus. And so we're sort of left with almost like policy by radio talk show. And I'm not sure that that's going to work out super great.
I think a good representation of this is that I had a stuffed animal as a child named Toto von Bismarck that might actually be a good figurehead for this administration.
I was going down a slightly less whimsical line, which was that just to kind of talk on Aaron's point a little bit further and re-wonkify us. It's not only really hard in the 21st century because of a whole host of transparency and, frankly, the nature of personal relationships and leadership, but also because our economic policies and national security policies are deeply and almost inextricably intertwined now.
That's right.
And so I think, you know, dealing with China on one without the other, dealing with Europe on one without the other, almost doesn't make sense. And you just can't have a single leader and a single point and a transactional relationship on one without the other. And so we kind of need an overarching strategy and a policy apparatus that can say, okay, if we're doing this on the national security side, where are our Treasury people and our State Department Economic Bureau people to talk?
Would you like an interagency process, Rada?
I sure would.
That's nuts.
Everybody read
first,
Eli Lake
first
this
I'd
week.
Like interagency staff and then a process, actually.
Okay, I have a final thought that somebody else is going to have to expound on because we don't have enough time. Somebody needs to write an analogy of the movie Pretty in Pink and the Trump administration national security process.
Interesting.
And I'm just going to leave it at that.
Interesting. All right. I like it. Challenge to the audience.
Anthony Michael Hall, I think, might be Trump. Just leaving it there.
Fascinating.
So this week on Bombshell, we have special guests. That's right, guests multiple. We have our moms who are all going to be interviewed by each of us. We'll talk a little bit of national security. We'll ask our bombshell questions, and then we will get the real dirt and secrets on each of the bombshells here.
We're going to start with Lauren's mom, Trisha, then my mom, Jenny, and finally Radha's mom, Rama. Enjoy. Hi, Trisha. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to meet you guys.
We're going to ask you just a couple of our usual bombshell questions and then move on to some meaty Mother's Day pieces. Can you tell us about the best meal you've had while traveling?
The best meal that I've had while traveling was in Monument Valley. My husband and I had been hiking and we were hot and sweaty, and we were driving back to our hotel, which all of this is in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing around. There's a shack on the side of the road, and they're selling Indian fry bread.
Oh.
And it was absolutely fantastic.
This is very similar to Lauren's story.
Yeah. Did they have Fanta there?
For Oreos?
Exactly.
Fanta and Oreos? God, yeah.
We were wondering, what is the first major national security event you remember, and what impression did you take away from it?
So I'm going to say, I was very young. I was only like 4 and a half when John F. Kennedy was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember exactly like when he was shot, but I remember how the reaction of all the people, and everybody is very upset and sad. And I remember the funeral on our very old black and white TV, watching that. And I'm not really sure why I remember, because I was so young, but it just obviously made a big impression on me because of the way that everybody reacted to it.
Yeah, I can imagine. So that time in history was also the period of the Cold War. And because we think about these things a lot, we were kind of wanting to know if our parents thought about nuclear war during the Cold War, or if that was something that was just very far away from all your experiences?
You know, I'm going to say probably, especially when I was younger, elementary school, it wasn't any sort of a focus. It wasn't anything I thought of a lot. People traveling into space and going to the moon, that was something that I definitely remember more than anything about the Cold War. I have had a friend that told me that I think she was more, I think in the 50s, early 60s in elementary school, and they used to have practice where they would get under their desks in case bombs mm-hmm. were dropped. And I'm thinking, well, if you're having a nuclear war, I'm not real sure how that would help you. But they would actually have that happen, and they practice getting, they would get on buses and go and drive away. But when I was a kid, I really don't have much of a thought about that. I was in my own little world.
And do you remember anything about the Vietnam War? Did that politicize or energize you in any particular way?
Well, I actually do remember the first part that I remember about the Vietnam War, again, a lot of that, it lasted so long, I was very young at first, but I remember when it started being on the news on TV, because for a long time, they would talk about it, but nothing, there were no pictures or no video mm-hmm. of the war. So I do remember when they started having the cameras that would follow with the soldiers, and they would have the videos. And then one thing that always I had a memory of was they would post the number of people that were injured and the number of people that were killed that day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And that just really was, I mean, it was a lot of people. Yeah. And to have that posted and then see those pictures, it was just, it definitely had an impact.
Yeah, for sure. So moving on to the somewhat funnier questions, what was Lauren like as a kid, and was she always like this?
Okay, well, that's a twofold question. So Lauren as a kid always had a book, mm-hmm. or if not two or three books with her, wherever she went. I used to say that we helped keep the library open because of all the fines that we would get. books that couldn't be found, or books that were, you know, hidden under the stuff that was on her floor in her bedroom. That kind of thing. And her dad was a football coach. We would go to the games on Friday night, and Lauren would be sitting there with the band playing and the football going on, and Lauren sitting there reading a book. And people will still come to me and say, you know, I remember watching Lauren at football games, and she's just reading the whole time.
She was very popular, I'm sure.
Exceptionally so. Homecoming queen.
Yeah, exactly. She, when she turned 16 and got her driver's license, we used to have to give her directions on where to go, and Keller at that time wasn't a huge town. She didn't know where to go anywhere because she had always read when she was in the car. So we would have to give her very specific directions.
I do not get car sick.
Well, that's all the questions we have. Thank you for joining us for a special Mother's Day edition of our Bombshell podcast.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
We'll make sure Lauren calls you later this week.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, Erin.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I've got Radha and Lauren here, and Radha's going to ask you some questions for our special Mother's Day edition of Bombshell.
Hello.
Okie dokie. Hi, Radha. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. And so we're going to ask you a couple of our sort of usual Bombshell questions here that we ask all of our guests. Okay, what is a fan club that you are a member of or that you would like to admit here on the air to us?
I would say that the fan club I'm the member of is KU Jayhawk basketball.
Rock chalk.
I'm shocked to hear that, Jenny. That's amazing that you and Aaron would have nothing in common except for Jayhawk baseball, or basketball,
yes,
rather.
Basketball, yes.
The bar that my parents met at is, in fact, still opened.
And, oh, my gosh.
You know, it's still very much there.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What is the best geek field trip you've been on?
The best geek field trip? Well, I have two answers to that. One year, my husband and I took Erin and her sister to Chicago, and we went to all kinds of museums and the Art Institute and, over a long weekend. And that was very fun.
We went to the Field Museum. So you see the dinosaurs.
Yeah,
Science and industry. It's pretty good.
Right, science and industry, all the aquarium, all that stuff. And the other geek field trip, if I can qualify it as such, is a couple years ago, Aaron and I went to Universal Studios together to the Wizarding World of Harry Potter.
Oh, so, that's awesome.
Pretty good.
It's a pretty good adult geek field trip.
Seems to be a recurring theme.
All right, so we're going to move on and ask you a couple of our sort of national security questions. So what is the first major national security event you remember? Sort of what something that sticks in your mind from when you were a kid?
I would have to say that would be the Cuban Missile Crisis with President Kennedy.
What do you remember about that, Mom?
I just remember being scared. I remember it was on the news all the time. Nobody knew what was going to happen. Nobody knew what Khrushchev was going to do. It was just scary. And everyone was relieved when it got resolved. And after that, I also remember several families in my neighborhood started building bomb shelters.
Oh, wow. What do you remember at the Vietnam War? Do you remember, was that a big thing?
I do. Yeah, I do remember after the Vietnam War. I would have been in high school then. I was very much my father's daughter at that time, and he is a staunch Republican. So I had many friends who protested against the Vietnam War, but I did not. And actually, as I think back on it, that's probably one of my regrets. I wish I had been better informed. I wish I would have taken a stand then, along with all the other people that I knew who were doing that.
And you got to KU just the fall after the students had firebombed the Union, right? Which had been a pretty big development, obviously, on college yes. campuses there. Grandma wasn't yes, very happy about that.
that is correct. I remember her looking at the headlines in the paper and going, "This is where you're going to school?"
Yes, and isn't it great,
yes.
Mom?
yes, I am.
So shifting gears to our slightly more lighter Mother's Day oriented question, tell us the truth. What was Erin like as a kid? Was she always like this?
Erin has looked the same and acted the same since the day she was born. she has always been this way. Although
it was really
say,
fun to be a seven-year-old, I have to say.
Exactly. I have to say that I actually think she's mellowed a bit as she's gotten older.
It's the alcohol.
Well, it probably helps.
So you can imagine how difficult my life as a young mother was.
I imagine the alcohol also helps with that.
That's true. You deserve an award, though.
Oh, she deserves lots of awards. Most of my family does.
Yes. Did you think Erin would go into this field of sort of national security, counterterrorism, all the crazy stuff she's worked on?
I'm not sure that I thought specifically that she would go into this, you know, area. I knew that she got interested in it, studying at KU in the honors program there. And I remember one time talking with her and saying, "Well, why don't you be like the political correspondent for CNN?" And she said, "No, I want to be the one they come to for special commentary."
Ooh. All right. Well, what is something that your daughter drinks that you just don't understand?
Bourbon.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. You don't drink cocktails, really, do you, Mom?
No, I don't. I'm pretty much a red wine drinker and margaritas. Those
you
would
have
be
exceptionally
my go-to
good taste.
Drinks.
Well, I think that's all of our questions, Mom.
That's all the questions. I didn't get a chance to say how much you and I are exactly alike now that you're grown up to be a
Yeah, we're going
to
edit that right out.
Yeah. Well, Jenny, it was wonderful to meet you. Thank you for being on.
Theo, you're very welcome. I enjoyed meeting both you guys. And I have to tell you, I really am impressed with your podcast. I think it's just so cool that you three young, intelligent women are just telling everybody exactly what's going on and that you're so smart about it.
Thanks, Mom. Love you.
All right. Love you, too. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Hello?
Hi, Mom.
Oh, hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I have you on speaker.
So, hi, we're here with Radha's mom, Rama, and it's so wonderful to have you here on Bombshell. We are going to ask you first a couple of our Bombshell interview questions and move on to a few other Mother's Day special questions. The first one what we wanted to ask was, what is the book that you have either owned the longest or read the most?
I think... I'm going to say Plato.
Wow. It's a highbrow answer.
Wow.
I thought for sure it was going to be a Jane Austen one.
I mean, that would be a great answer as well. But both of those are fabulous. So,
well, I mean, you asked me what I don't keep rereading. You know, when I was, in my teens and early college, Jane Austen was a huge, huge, I was a big Jane Austen fan. I think I read all her books. And I really liked the language. I think she has a good way with words, which is why I liked it.
I think I've read every Jane Austen book maybe 12 times, so I very much identify with this answer. This is great. Right, so now we're going to move into more of our Mother's Day national security questions. And Radha has told us a little bit about some of your answers, so I'm fascinated to hear. What is the first major national security event that you remember?
Well, that's what I was telling Radha, that I don't know if your audience would be interested, but, you know, I was in India at that time. And in India, and it's a tradition that the mothers go to have their babies at their parents' house, mm-hmm. right? So my mom had gone, my father was living in the north, my mom had gone down to the south where we are from, to have my sister Sheila. And while we were there, war broke out between China and India. Now, I don't know if you know the history of this, but in the 50s, when China marched into Tibet, India gave shelter to the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big point of contention with China, right?
Yeah.
So there were some minor border skirmishes, and China just came over and, they had a fight, and then they kind of decided to have a ceasefire. And fortunately, at that time, you had the Cuban Missile Crisis in the U.S. So neither the U.S. nor Russia was too interested. Had they gotten involved, it could have gotten out of hand. So in a way, I think that worked out.
I think so.
Probably. That's right.
Neither power got involved, and so the Chinese and the Indians worked it out, and they haven't really had a major war since then.
I think this is the first conversation in which anyone has been grateful for the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I completely agree. I'm very thankful that they did not get involved there. I think we could spend probably another 20 minutes of the podcast talking about that. But for the sake of time, I'll move on to another question. So one of the major events, political events in my mother's life when she was young that she remembers most passionately is the Vietnam War. And the same thing with a lot of other people in her generation. But that, I'm going to guess, had less of an impact in shaping your generation from where you were growing up. But I'm curious, did that have any impact on the news and the political discussion? Or if not, was there some other event in the political dialogue that really impacted, you know, your youth when you were growing up?
You know, it's kind of interesting you bring that up, because the Vietnam War per se did not really impact India, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where I was at that time.
Right.
But the kind of an interesting sideline, when the 60s rebellious generation was coming here, they also discovered India. There used to be a lot of hippies in New Delhi, which is where we live.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go into the center of New Delhi, which is a place where all the commercial buildings are, called Connaught Place, which, Radha, you might have gone this year.
Yep.
And if you go there, there is this big central area, and there are all the restaurants and all there. And all the hippies, American hippies, would be all around there. It was very interesting, because we would go out to have dinner every weekend there. And often, believe it or not, we used to buy dinner for those people, because they did not have enough money.
Right.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating.
And we had great conversations. My dad was a professor, so he was used to lecturing children and college kids.
I know, it would be really interesting to see my grandfather lecturing some American hippies on the streets of Delhi.
Oh my God. Well, speaking of lecturing children, Aaron and I are very curious to know, what was Radha like as a child? And has she always been this way since she's gotten older?
I don't know which way she is there right now. But she was pretty precocious, right? And she was walking and talking and always let her mind be known. So we went to a party when she was like 2.5 or something. And the father of the kid whose party it was filming all the kids. And he asked Radha, how do you like the party? And she said, the party is great. And he said, how do you like the cake? She says, I don't like the cake. It's too sweet. So, you know, I don't think she's changed much since then.
No, not really.
No, not at all.
Did you ever think that she would go into this field, or what did you think that she would be when she was a child?
Well, I didn't really have any preconception, and we didn't have it for either Radha or her sister, of what they should be when they grew up. But I did have an inkling when she went for an interview and the guy asked her what she'd like to be when she grew up, and she said she'd like Alan Greenspan's job.
I set my sights low.
Yeah.
Very modest child.
Wow. So how did you know who Alan Greenspan was as a child?
I'd prefer not to answer that question.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast this week. It was lovely to talk to you. And, you know, I think we need to have you back on as a guest later on to hear more about your life.
I don't know about that. But anyway, this is lovely. I'm wishing all your mothers a very happy Mother's Day. You guys have a great time.
Thank you.
Good luck with the podcast.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Let's move on. What's next, ladies? What are we watching? What are we watching this week and next week? What's coming up in the foreign policy, national security world?
So I am watching, the president has recently announced a lot of foreign travel in
his first trips.
Strange triumvirate of the Vatican, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. So sort of hitting all of the religious capitals, because why not? I'll be interested to see that because he goes there ahead of the NATO summit as well as the G7 in Italy. So there's going to be a lot of chances for the United States to talk a lot about foreign policy over the next several weeks that are, frankly, more so than it has in the while, beyond just press conferences and occasional events. They're going to have to be much more proactive in these trips than they have been over the last couple months or so. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out. I will also be interested to see the budget, which will theoretically be released in long form at some point in the time in the next few weeks.
This is the FY18 budget.
The FY18 budget. How much are they actually cutting the State Department and in what places? There's been a lot of leaks to this effect over the last few weeks that are really, really scary and disheartening. As well as I would be curious about a lot of the detail they have in the DoD plus up, which I think is not as much as others have intended, as we have talked about in the last few podcasts.
So I'm enthused to see the Pope and what he says to and about the president.
Subtweet him?
I just feel like the Pope has a lot of good stuff to say, and especially when he says things on plane. So I'm hoping they take a trip together somewhere, maybe on a plane, because the Pope, just trust me, I don't know what happens when he's on a plane, but that Pope, he has a lot of stuff to say. But I'm also interested, as we are in the sort of esoteric bureaucratic sense, that a lot of issues related to how national security clearances have been sort of coming up and popping up over time. And we see this periodically. You know, we're seeing it with Flynn now. We saw it with Snowden before. We saw it with Manning and a little bit with the Navy Yard shooter. And there was a 120-day report after the Navy Yard leaks. And I will be very interested to see if this prompts some additional action that is much needed in sort of reforming how our government vets and looks at people who were put in positions of trust, national security or otherwise. So
it's not a real time process.
It's not.
Right? And it's very much about self-disclosure.
Very much. And it's not continuous, mm-hmm. despite the fact that we would like it to be. And there are some efforts in that direction.
And it is really Byzantine. I mean, there's certainly an argument to be made to burn it all down.
Right. And I think, you know,
what would that even look like if you tried to recreate
it? One benefit of this
it?
Administration is they might be willing to do things like that, right? And we could really use a revamp of some of how our vetting and screening processes go. So we shall see.
That would be very, I would love to see them burn it down at some level. I'm very concerned about what would be put back in its place.
I don't know about burn it down, but at least a solid reform I think I could go get on board with.
And I'm watching, not in addition to all of these things, certainly the specific fallout from the Yates-Clapper hearing that's going on today on Monday when we're recording, and kind of how that plays out with regard to not just Flynn, but the broader big picture context of what was the Russian involvement in the election in 2016.
That's totally going to need to be a this is still a thing segment.
It's always still a thing. And the second thing I'm keeping an eye on is the zombie foreign policy idea of safe zones in Syria, which is the idea that we'll never die, and seems to now be the topic of high-level discussions between the U.S. and Russia. There's a meeting between Tillerson and Lavrov later this week, and we'll see if this now goes anywhere. There are a lot of reasons from my perspective why we haven't done this already, which is that it's not a very militarily sound idea, nor does it actually protect people on the ground at the end of the day. But no one listens to me, so we'll see kind of where this actually takes us.
I listen to you.
Well, you all listen. I mean, the bombshell audience listens to us, but...
The people deciding Syria policy, less so.
Probably less so.
Probably.
Last segment, still without a name, pop culture. We had kind of an interesting conversation a few days ago about one of our favorite authors, which I was surprised to learn we all read, because usually two of us read something,
the third. I'm usually the odd man out.
I haven't.
Oh,
sorry.
You haven't? So embarrassing.
Oh. I know. I asked whether or not I should read this, and I will pick up a William Gibson book. This is a preview. We're talking about William Gibson,
who is the author of Neuromancer, inventor of the world cyberspace.
Pattern Recognition.
Pattern Recognition was a great series,
great
the
book.
Blue Ant series. It's like the only person I've ever known who can combine the concepts involved in high-end designer jeans, DARPA programs, and national security.
I know, it's like everything I want in one book.
It's really fantastic. But there was an article a week or so ago in the New York Times about how we're getting a sequel to The Peripheral, which is William Gibson's most recent book of kind of near future speculative fiction. And it's going to be set in these two alternate universes of a Clinton victory and the real world of a Trump victory.
Oh,
and it's kind of blowing my mind.
So I confess, my William Gibson experience is that on my husband and I's first date, he gave me a copy of The Neuromancer, and I swore up
Bold
and down.
Move, Cotton.
Yep. I swore up and down that I would read it, and because it was one of his favorite books. I did not read it. Not only did I not read it, I lost it. And yet we're married. So just let that
Hope
be a lesson to
eternal.
You, girls. Yeah, let that be a lesson to you, girls. You can lie about your book interest and still snag a husband along the way.
Excellent. Well, you like Mara Jade, so
that's true.
That probably does some good at the end of. But there's a good. I mean, between William Gibson and Neal Stephenson, we've had a lot of really good near future speculative fiction.
It's right. I mean, the one thing I worry is like there's only so much dystopic future I can take at this point. So I'm just saying.
Are you watching The Handmaid's Tale?
I'm not, because I can't emotionally handle it.
That's the correct answer.
I need to get to a more stable place in my life.
I am watching it, and it's beautifully shot. I wish it were actually being filmed in Cambridge, where it's set. I think it's actually shot in Toronto, but it's tough to watch, and probably deliberately so.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to read about, so I just feel like I was like, nah.
I instead highly recommend The Expanse, which is a great sort of political sci-fi both novel and TV show that I would highly recommend to anybody, even if you don't like sci-fi, which what's wrong with you?
Probably lots of things.
That's fair.
All right. Well, from the ladies here at Bombshell, we wish everyone and their moms a happy Mother's Day.
Call your mom.
We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks.
Bye.